Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's December 18th, 2022, and welcome to episode 262 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way?
RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, 1962, two's complement, all things two. I'm Paul Hagstrom near Boston, and I'm joined by three retro computing enthusiasts this time. The first on my screen is Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Hi, everybody. I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I work in academia, and the semester's ending, and so, you know, I don't have any time to do this, but here I am. but yes, looking forward to the winter break that comes with being in academia. So,
well, we're happy you're here.
Yes, thanks. Next on my screen is Quinn Dunkey in the wilds of Vancouver. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. Very good. Yeah, in fact, it's we're in the midst of a giant blizzard as we speak, so I'm waiting for it to stop so I can shovel and not have to shovel twice, but I think I may literally have to shovel myself out at the end of the show because it just keeps coming and coming.
Very fun.
Yeah, we've gotten like 6 or 8 inches, I think, since this morning. So,
Somewhat different from Los Angeles.
Yes, a little bit. A little bit, yeah. Snow is rain that you have to clean up after, which is kind of annoying. It's good exercise, though. I actually kind of enjoy it. It's very satisfying because you can look at this giant pile of snow and realize that you did that. You made that snow be there.
Yeah, that seems pretty nice. I walked by a building that was under construction for a while, and I, you know, as it got to its last stages, I was thinking, you know, this might be actually a fun job to do, you know, like because you made this.
Yeah.
Anyway, fourth on my screen. Including myself, I guess, is Michael Mulhern in Sydney. How are you? Welcome back.
I'm fine. Definitely no sprinkles of snowman flesh out down this end of the world.
Oh, no. Now every time I see snow, I'm going to think snowman flesh. Terrible. That's good.
Sorry about that. Yeah, no, I saw that. I saw that one. I had to steal it.
But, yes.
We're in the throes of summer here, so we get warm snow flows through. So hoping my drainage and everything around the house can handle it. So the joys. If I'm not being threatened by bushfires, I'm being threatened by floods.
Yeah, it's at least it's some variety.
I wish it was boring for a change.
Yeah.
Well, you got to hope for them to happen at the same time because then the flood puts out the fire, you see.
So we've been, you know, sort of working through the years with our episode numbers. And so we have reached episode 262. This is the last episode we're going to record in 2022. So we can also look back on the year 2022. It has been 60 years since 1962. So just twos everywhere. So I guess basically we would just talk about, you know, the year that we have passed, the year coming up, or 1962. Your choice. Maybe all three. But I think we probably can start by pointing out that Space War came out in 1962.
Space War, the super important game on the DEC PDP-1 with that awesome persistent phosphor screen that looked like something from a 1960s movie about NORAD. And I think there are contentions about, was it the first computer game And like we were talking about before the show, first is always a dubious proposition. But it was certainly one of the first and one of the most well-known. And a really interesting concept. You had two ships orbiting a sun or some sort of stellar matter. You were trying to shoot each other while not getting sucked into the sun, because that would kill you, as it probably would in real life. It does in the game. There is a re-implementation of space war on one of my favorite retro-oriented websites called MassWorks, or maybe pronounced MassWerks, depending on the where you're at in the world. But it's a great site, and we'll have a link to it in the show notes. There's much more to explore on that site besides Space War, but on it you can find an implementation of Space War.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a lot of history about Space War. I think we probably talked about this when it was first, you know, when it first made an appearance on this site. But I've gone back to it repeatedly. Never gotten any better at the game, but it's actually a very, very hard game.
And someone will correct me if I'm wrong here, I'm sure, but I believe this is the game that was commercialized as Computer Space by Nolan Bushnell. So it was also kind of the first coin-op arcade game, I think. I think it's the same game. Yeah, there we go. Yeah, so it is the same, yeah. I don't know what hardware it ran on in the arcade version, if it was actually PDP hardware as well that was inside it, or if they did something else, but... Yeah, it was the cabinet is extremely distinctive because, you know, the arcades didn't exist yet, so they hadn't yet settled on the big plywood boxes that we know now. So the Computer Space cabinet is this crazy, yeah, there's a picture of it. There's this crazy fiberglass, like, alien pod-looking thing. And they're notoriously fragile, so it's rare to find them intact because of all the crazy fiberglass. If you want to see one intact and working, there's a YouTube channel called John's Arcade. He's got one. He's a collector and restorer of arcade hardware, and he managed to get one. And they're very, very strange looking. And by all accounts, the game is not very good, and it didn't really succeed very well. So, of course, we all know Nolan's second outing into the arcades, which was Pong. And, of course, Pong was a raging, raging success. Mm-hmm. We all have heard the stories of operators or bar owners calling them for service because the machine had stopped working because the coin box was over jammed full of quarters. They couldn't keep up with emptying the coin boxes. It was so successful. So, and the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, that is a pretty wild machine. I don't think I had quite understood what I was looking at when I've seen pictures of this before, but this is really sinking in for me for the first time now.
It must have been outrageously expensive to make. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a very complicated fiberglass form that they would have had to lay. I have no idea why they chose to make it that way. I guess they were really swinging for the fences with the with the experience there.
Yeah.
Maybe the person doing it thought it was easier than throwing some particle board together.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the first Pong machines did not look anywhere near that cool.
No. Very quickly, Atari settled on plywood and crappy 70s veneers for arcade machines, and yeah, everyone else followed suit.
Yeah. Let's see, what else? Another thing, so 1962, according to the Center for Computing History, the first commercial modem was manufactured, and this seems like one of those things where you've got a lot of modifiers narrowing the field so that there is not much competition. But
although the Bell modems, I think, were really, really, really important. Right, set some standards that things tended to support on almost ad infinitum. So that Bell 103 modem coming out in 62 mm-hmm. seems like an important milestone, even if you didn't want to call it a first of any kind.
Yeah, people did modems before, but Bell did modems right or something.
Or maybe because they were giant.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, got down to the stage for anyone to pop in. Hell, where would you go to buy a modem back in those days?
What, in 1962?
Yeah, it's not exactly going to go down to your local computer store, is it?
Best Buy, right?
Yeah. I think that's right.
Bell R Us. But no, it's all kind of gone downhill from there.
Gosh, look at that. It's just, it says shortly after the Bell 103 came the Bell 212. Yeah. I'm surprised. I would have thought I thought the distance was longer. I sort of felt like 300 baud lasted for a long time.
Well, and I think this stuff lasted longer on the consumer side because, of course, the new thing was incredibly expensive, and I think prices were slower to come down in those days. So maybe 1200 BPS existed as far back as 1965 or whatever, but it took until the mid-70s for it to be affordable.
Yeah. Although, I mean, I think it wasn't affordable for me until like mid-80s.
Yeah, 80s maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, sometime in the late 80s, early 90s was my first modem, and that was still 300 baud because I couldn't afford to go one of those high-speed 1200s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Hayes 1200, or did US Robotics make a 1200? I'm pretty sure they did.
I think so, yeah.
But those, yeah, they were pretty pricey.
I had, when I was in school, I was able to borrow for a summer, I think, an acoustic 300 baud coupler. So my first modem wasn't mine. It was a borrowed 300 baud coupler, and that's I'm pretty pleased that I had the experience. I think this comes up every time we talk about the couplers, but the problem is that even if you could find a phone line to use it on, no phone fits in it anymore. I mean, like, you know, I was actually looking at, in fact, I think if we look back at the novelty at the gift guides, you know, from old episodes of the RCR podcast, you can find we had like a novelty handset for your cell phone, which is probably the right shape. I mean, you know, it's supposed to be just for hipsters, but it might actually be, you know, useful in quotes.
I was looking at one of those recently, and I don't know any way to know if it's the same form factor as the original Bell telephones that we would have used with those couplers, but if I could guarantee one was, I probably would get it, because I've got a couple of acoustic couplers, and, you know, the whole analog to digital thing going through a cell phone doesn't tend to make modems happy at the higher speeds, but somehow I feel like 110 baud or 300 baud would still work, even with all the digital jitter introduced by that.
Yeah.
I don't know who I'd call that would have a modem.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I picked up a acoustic coupler with all the intentions of cobbling something together, and then I looked around at the phones that I had available, and yeah, okay, what do I do now? I can't make the Garfield phone fit in it. The mobile phone's not going to fit in it. Used to sort of have the standard, air quotes, handsets all around the house back when I was a kid, and now I'm out there on my lonesome in adult land and not a compatible phone to be found.
Yeah.
Acoustic couplers were a fascinating kind of convergence of time, because the only reason they were possible was because of this weird rule where you were legally banned from plugging anything into the phone line that was not owned by Bell. Mm-hmm. And that allowed them to force us all to rent our phones from them. And thus we all had these standard phones. And even in Canada, we had the same ones. It wasn't Bell up there, but it was a similar monopoly, and they were the same phones, I think, imported from the States. And it was a silly thing created by a giant corporate monopoly that we all had the same phones, and thus you could make an acoustic coupler that anyone could use.
Yeah.
Mm.
Some folks in the chat were saying, by the way, that in the comments, early 80s, and they were having 300 baud modems. So as I think we were recalling, early 80s, 300 baud was still a thing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, these things, these hipster coupler, hipster, you know, handsets are not so expensive that it wouldn't be maybe worth just trying it. They look right, but who knows if they're just like a little bit too small or something.
Right.
Yeah, the scale is hard to judge, yeah. I wouldn't be shocked if you got one and it was like comically little, you know. Yeah. That tends to happen when you buy schlocky stuff on Amazon. It turns out to be half the size you thought it was going to be.
Looking at this, though, boy, those pictures. I mean, it is hard to judge scale, but it does look like maybe it would work.
Yeah, it looks close. Yeah.
Man, that'd be fun.
Yeah. It seems like you could make a business model out of, like, you know, recycling old phones and, you know, adding a USB thing to them. So, I mean, that would be one way to make sure they're the right size if they are actual old phones. What else? Oh, yeah. So I don't know much about this, but I came across it when I was looking at 1962 things. It is NCR CRAM, new generation in external memory. It is card-based random access storage, which I think is just beautiful as an idea. Probably would actually work better, you know, or last longer than, you know, 3.5-inch disks. But I think they come in cartridges of 256 cards.
Yeah, just sort of looking here, it says each CRAM deck of 256 cards recorded around 5.5 megabytes.
So it's like an expansion board inside, like there's an edge connector of some sort, and it's just got a bunch of RAM chips on it, or how does it actually work? Oh no, it's something else. It's like some kind of magnetic medium. I don't understand what this thing is.
I'm just reading here. CRAM cartridges contain 256 3x14-inch cards with a PET film magnetic recording surface.
Oh,
okay. Okay. So
they're magnetic.
They went by initial illusions, delusions, or whatever of somehow using a box of punch cards as random access. That would have been scary.
Because that would have been really cool, actually.
Yeah.
Sort of like a CD-ROM.
Yeah, cards suspended from 8 D-section rods, which were selectively rotated to release a specific card, each card having a unique pattern of notches at one end. So it looks like the magnetic media was physically identified. Selected card was dropped and wrapped around a rotating drum and then read or written. Okay, so it's an auto-loading drum memory.
Yeah, or like a tape drive where the tape has been chopped up into sections that can be swapped
yeah.
around.
Yeah.
That's kind of neat.
I can't see why this didn't succeed and rule the world.
Yeah, it actually, I mean, honestly, it does seem like it's pretty nice.
Could you imagine what would happen if two program decks got spilt and mixed together?
I mean, it seems better than a lot of other stuff people were using at the time, honestly. So, yeah, it is surprising it wasn't more popular.
I think it must have been superseded. It must have been that something better came along right after it, or something that superseded
yeah,
it.
Yeah, like otherwise... Winchester discs or something maybe came along really quickly, yeah. Or reel-to-reel tapes got fast.
There was a lot of rapid, you know, the advancement in the 50s and 60s was just, I mean, we think in the 80s we had rapid advancement, but back then stuff was moving so fast that something like this probably would not have had much of an opportunity to be in the market before it would get deprecated for something else. But
yeah.
I do love the acronym, though.
Yeah.
Mm. It wins the acronym contest for sure. Well, yeah, because in the 80s, we were iterating on established technologies like tapes and floppies, and they were getting better, but the paradigms were set. The 50s, 60s, it was much more, they were iterating entire paradigms. Like, they had no idea what technology was even going to be used to, you know, for storage. Like, is it going to be cards? Is it going to be tapes? Is it going to be discs? Like, we don't even know. So we're just trying everything. You know, mercury delay lines and crazy things.
Yeah. I would love to see one of these in action, but no, just reading it. The loader used a group of electromagnetic solenoids to slam a card into the control rods. The unit was a monster with two large electric motors that drove four large vacuum blowers. It was possible to have up to five cards in motion at any one point in time, dropping one to the drum, two to the return transport, and one being loaded back onto the deck.
Wow.
Sounds so like cool.
Quite a machine. It sounds a lot like an early Xerox, actually, because they did a lot of that same thing where they take sheets of paper and they throw them onto a spinning drum with the vacuum pressure and then spin them around and throw them out. And
I remember all those early laser printers and things, the IBM 3725 was a vacuum fed cut sheet laser printer. They thought they could get higher speeds. Was it 3827? Was 3827. Yeah, they thought they could get higher speeds than just the rubber pickup wheels. That was very sort of like typical for copier machines of the day.
Mm-hmm.
But the first Xerox printers, yeah. But yeah, it was an interesting era, as you said, the 50s and 60s. Let's invent the paradigms first before we start doing iterative improvements.
All right.
Definitely would love to see one of these working. Then would love to see it fail. So much to go wrong.
Yeah, I bet they fail spectacularly. Just explosion of cardboard and magnetic goo.
Here's an interesting little comment there. It says, another interesting feature was that should an app operator accidentally drop all the cards from a cartridge, they could be replaced without worrying about order. The order of the cards was not important because of the notch encoding system on each individual card. One would have to hope that having the cards in a good sequence would make access faster, but there's the random. Yeah. So like, oh, there's a box of cards. Let me pick one. No, let me pick another.
Who goes pick a card, any card, something like that?
Three of diamonds. Yep. No, it's supposed to be the inventory system.
Let me move on to some of the feedback. I've collected a bunch, and I don't know how much we'll actually talk about, but so I'll just go through in the order they are in my notes. One is the Herb on Facebook gave us another thing from the BBC archive, which is Douglas Adams talking, on the BBC about the computer games and working with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy Infocom game. And it's all, it's all very silly, but so it's sort of mocking the TV show, but then it's actually just a bit of a discussion with Douglas Adams on this. It's pretty interesting to hear him talk.
Yeah, the article on Digital Antiquarian, Jimmy Marr's article about Hitchhikers, is also a great read. Apparently, Douglas Adams was pretty insufferable to work with, and there's some pretty amusing interviews from that time about how they basically had to just put up with him, and the person, was it Steve Moretzky or whoever ended up doing that game, it was basically the person who could put up with Douglas Adams the longest is who ended up finishing that project.
Interesting. I didn't... sort of listen to every minute of this. So, but it seemed like at the end there was some sort of speculative discussion of how CD-ROMs might be used in voice recognition technology in order to do the next generation of games. But it seemed like it was being played as if it actually existed. So, I don't know. Anyway, he's not that insufferable to listen to in an interview. He might be insufferable to work with on a game.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. He's certainly charming and funny in interviews and so on. Yeah, apparently he was just more interested in being sort of a wealthy drunken playboy than he was in actually doing any work. So when they needed him to check the writing on things or approve things or sign off on things, apparently it was very difficult to figure out which party house he'd fallen asleep in last night and track him down and get him to sign things. Apparently the story.
Excellent.
I like very much, by the way, that the I'm assuming that was a programmer a few seconds ago in the video you were playing.
It was actually someone at a Hitchhiker's convention describing. So it's a game player.
That's why it makes sense that he has his
tail. That explains the tail.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's a rabid fan of some kind.
The line between programmer and rabid fan at convention is very blurry.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. So Mark on Twitter sent us this link. And the note I made here was there were a lot of Apple II clones. There must have been like 10 or something, right? And this is a computer models database specifically with the filter on Apple II clones. And it goes on and on and on and on and on. and, actually sort of going through it, there are some ones that were sort of notable that now that I think about it, I knew about them, but I mean, good grief.
That's insane. We've talked before about what it would be like to try and be an Apple II clone collector, like if someone set out to try and collect them all. So this is the first list I've ever seen that might be sort of complete of all of them, but holy cow.
And it has once we've heard of them, like the Microprofessor 2 we keep talking about,
And the pineapple and the Franklin and the lemon and some of those I've heard of, but... Mm. Holy cow, there's...
And of course, you got to have a wombat.
Yeah, the wombat. Yeah, it was said every country at the time wanted to have their own computer industry. Like everyone was, you know, especially like South America and Eastern Europe and so on. They all really wanted to have their own homemade computer industry, but they didn't have the infrastructure to really do that. So I think cloning the Apple II was how a lot of them did it. So it's, I'm sure, no accident that you see like different clones from pretty much every country in the world here.
Were these licensed clones or are most of them not?
I think none of them were actually.
Oh, okay.
Because yeah, I think Apple wasn't even smart enough at the time to think about maybe they should have a licensing system or something. And because I think the 2 Plus was cloned so much because it was all Apple, it was all off-the-shelf parts. Like it was literally just a bunch of TTL chips that you could frankly buy at Radio Shack. And I think that's why it was so cloned. You know, you couldn't clone an Atari 800 or a Commodore 64. You know, it had specialized chips that were vertically integrated. Like, you know, no, you weren't going to be able to clone that, but the Apple II.
Yeah, so many to choose from, but going purely on looks, and that's the reason I bought mine, yeah. Is the Microsoft Havoc.
Yeah, that one is so excellent. Those are really excellent looking. I've seen one.
Yeah. Yep. Stick a twin warp nacelles on it, and you've got yourself a Star Trek shuttle. I just wish I had a monitor that was a monitor with the same aesthetic. That's basically what I've got: the CPU with a floppy drive, the extra floppy drive, and then that lovely monstrous keyboard. It's quite a nice keystroke on it. As far as keyboards go, it's quite a usable one if you can reach in that far to use it. But
there was one made an appearance at Kansas Fest some years ago, so I've seen one.
Wouldn't have been mine. It was expensive enough to actually ship it to Australia, liberating it from the evil clutches of some North American overlord.
There was, I think when we talked about this, I mean, we probably talked about it 2 years ago or something like that, but there was maybe a set of eBay auctions, or there was some interaction with someone who like worked for the company or whose father worked for the company or something like that. So there's actually some inside information.
I would love to get my hands on the manuals and any of discs for it. But back to clones. The big thing is that the marketing department says compatible and the engineering says clone.
There were some great ones. Let's see. There was the Monkey One from Big Monkey Computer.
I've never heard of that one. Yeah. It has me intrigued.
There was the Lisa 2.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
What country is that? I don't recognize the flag.
I'm not sure.
Is that CSK. Netherlands? CSK.
Could be. Yeah. yeah. I don't know. I think I have a version of this one called the Ready Go. which is nice because it actually, you know, like if you replace the AdWords Apple II in the ROM, you know, that it displays on the screen, it fits perfectly, ready to go.
That was a common thing with these clones, actually. You could see when they had just copied the ROM and, you know, they gave them a name. Like you see a lot of them here, there's Space 2 and Sepple 2 and Recom 2, Peach 2. Like those are all words they can just overwrite the word Apple in the ROM. It's, I'm sure, not an accident.
Yeah. There were actually some sort of like hardware checks were specifically looking for that. Like, you know, does it say Apple here? If it doesn't, then, you know, don't start ProDOS.
Why would you want to order ProDOS? That's that newfangled operating system.
That's the one you have to type a million characters just to get into a directory.
Oh, I know. DOS 3.3 forever.
We looked at a clone a while back that they had named it such that like the first two letters in that position in the ROM were still AP because it turns out that's all that ProDOS was looking for. Mm-hmm. So it was advertised as famously as a ProDOS compatible Apple II clone. I don't remember which one it was though, but it was called like the Applicon or something, and they had put like AP something 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 in the ROM, and so that the first two characters being checked were still valid. It was extremely clever, but I don't remember which clone that was. It was many years ago that we talked about that.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, probably enough of that. But there are many. and it's always nice to talk about the Havoc. Gareth wrote, alerting us to ignorance of the Leo computer is a kind of a cautionary tale of something. But there's a book we can read, and the book apparently is very good. It's called A Computer Called Leo, Lion's Tea Shop and the World's First Office Computer. And this is apparently pretty good. So it's available for Kindle in the UK, but not in the US. So I haven't quite managed to read it.
I read this story somehow, but it wasn't this book. Where did I encounter this story? It was in some other retro book or maybe a YouTube video, or somehow I read about this. I don't recall where.
Well, and we did talk about it here. like some episodes ago, which prompted the, I mean, I think we largely had said we had never heard of it before encountering it here, which is what prompted the listener to point out the book.
I think I'll just put this in my wish list, but yeah, interesting that the paperback is $12.57, and then for an extra 40 cents, you can have the hardcover.
Mm-hmm. Well, honestly, I think of hardcovers as being, you know, like in my early years, I thought of them as kind of like the luxury versions of the book, and now I think of them as the take up way too much space versions of the book.
Yeah, I'm sort of torn between books being able to stand up by themselves or cramming an extra 3 into the shelf.
Right.
I'm leaning more towards the cramming the extra 3 into the shelf days now, but...
Okay, let's see what else to say. I don't know much about this, but... Curtis wrote. Actually, Curtis is here. Maybe Curtis can in the chat tell us about this. But Curtis wrote to alert us to the fact that Nitros 9, ease of use project, has reached 1.0 as of the beginning of December. I am not super aware of what this project is, but I guess it's basically making this version of OS 9, Nitros 9, more easily accessible and usable. This is a color computer based operating system, I believe.
It's specifically Cocoa 3, right?
Mm. Yeah, I've always wanted to sort of like find out more about it because it being OS 9, and back in the day I was one of the other OS 9 users.
This OS 9 is a 6809 based operating system, is that correct? I think it was an alternative. It's a fan-made alternative for color computers on the 6809, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and I've always sort of heard good things about it. And in fact, you know, that's like one of the things I wanted to try, like with those coprocessor cards. You can get a 6809 for coprocessor card. I think I have one somewhere, that would be one of the things I would like to see if I could do something with, but.
So Curtis has confirmed in the chat that, yeah, it's a 6809-based OS inspired, loosely based on Unix. So it would be sort of like GNO on the Apple IIgs, like a fan-made, somewhat Unix-y operating system that's supposed to be better than what the company was offering, I guess. It looks pretty slick. Oh. The screenshots and stuff are pretty impressive.
Mm. Oh, I mean, I'm intrigued, especially if it's sort of like a fan-built one. I love playing with that kind of stuff.
And I do have a Cocoa 3 that I haven't done anything with, and it seems like this might be a nice way to, you know, try out both things at once.
Mm.
Someone got a free one that year at Kansas Fest. There was a lone Cocoa 3 on the table.
I know.
People almost died lunging for it. They're not that common.
Yeah, I would have loved to have got it, but I actually used it as a distraction so that while people were piling in towards that, I went for something which was nearby. It was...
So you're the one who grabbed the bell and howl.
Some software and manuals that I wanted to grab and scan.
It was the Image Writer 2s, right? You wanted 7 Image Writer 2s?
That's right. 6 was not enough.
I've never actually bought, used, or owned an Image Writer 2. I've still got my Image Writer 1.
Come to Kansas Fest, you can have 7.
Yep.
Always a stack of them, and there's always a stack of them again next year.
I don't think I have enough weight allowance on any flight to bring home that many Image Writers.
Mm-hmm. Even one, that is kind of the problem. They're great printers, but yeah, they weigh about 100 pounds.
Yeah, I'm looking at getting saw someone local, as in this part of the state, with a 15-inch Image Writer 1.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Wouldn't mind getting that.
I just got one of those.
Yeah, I think I have one too, actually.
Pop it in the mail. Just put in a padded Jiffy bag and send it to me.
It is heavy.
Yeah.
I am exactly, not going to lie.
And I just move it from like table to table. I haven't done a thing with it, but I mean, I sort of...
What, before one table collapses, you move it to another one?
That's right.
It's just that my ImageWriter 1, I just had it hooked up and running on so many computers and systems from originally with the Apple IIc. I made the cable to fit and run it off a Mac. I've run it off DOS and Windows through to... I think the last Windows I had it running on was Windows 2000. Still just plodding away doing listings and things for me.
So one thing I will point out before we move off the topic, Curtis noted in the chat, you can try this Nitros 9 in emulators also, if you're not lucky enough to have a Cocoa 3, which I am not that lucky. Emulators like VCC, MAME, and XROAR, none of which I've ever lit up, but now I'm going to have to, because the Cocoa 3 is just, from what I understand, impressive in its own right, and trying out this community OS seems like a lot of fun.
Yeah. Curtis also said that it was commercial in the early to mid 90s, and then was made open source. So
nice.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Mark on Facebook pointed out that the 8-bit shack is now open, and this at least the current highlight there is the Angry Birds for the Apple II. Michael, you said you just got it, right?
Yeah, my copy of Irked Avians has arrived, and I haven't had a chance to fire it up, but yeah, I really love what they're doing there at the 8-bit shack. It's sort of like software on floppy disk, not quite on demand, but it is an excellent implementation of Apple low-res graphics. With the split screen for the play, what programmers are doing today with not just the Apple but all of the 8-bit machines, and are really pushing the graphics and the programming and everything. But he's also, Mark was I think on a post, was offering that if people had software that they wanted to sell or make available for download, that they were going to sort of like offer the 8-bit shack as a way of distributing. So yeah. I think that's an excellent way of doing it. But yeah,
that's very nice. I think last time we talked, so we did talk about this game before, and last time we talked about it, it wasn't possible to order, but now there's a store for it and stuff, so you can order your physical copy, or you can just download it, but.
Yeah, I think it's one of there are free software on there, but I believe that Angry Birds is still only purchase. But if you purchase it, you can get it on either the floppy disk option or the download option. And as soon as I saw that you could get it on floppy disk, that was the box that I ticked, and only just recently arrived. All I've done is opened up the packing to make sure everything was there, and unlike other people, that my floppy disk hadn't been creased.
Nice.
Yes, a few local mail systems seem to not know how to suitably handle floppy disks.
Right.
They think that you can fold them in half and put them into letterboxes.
I was just sort of looking. We were talking a little bit last time about like the sort of crucialness of the physics in the real Angry Birds game, and so you can sort of see a little bit about it. The physics is a bit 8-bit.
Yeah, well, it's an 8-bit world.
It's simplified, so yeah. I think that it seems like they have a decent solution, because that. Would of course be prohibitively expensive to do for real the way that the original did, but they've kind of converted it into sort of Boulder Dash style physics where you know, you've got blocks that kind of fall straight down, and you know, I think that works fine for this.
Yeah, I just think that the artwork in that, the graphics is superb. Just that implementation of watching the playthroughs, I get lost and so like in the graphics and no longer see the blockiness. It's just amazing.
So let's see who wrote, Andrew wrote on Facebook, just to point out that the person who was responsible for the Commodorian that we talked about last time actually also is an accomplished demo scene musician known as LFT.
That explains a lot, actually, yep, about how well he was able to play that contraption.
So you can go to 15 Years of Scene Spirit, which is a YouTube video that has a sort of collection of songs, or there's a link. You can listen to it on Spotify if you'd like. Let's see what else. I don't know who wrote about this. Paul, perhaps. The author wrote about this. Going Online in the Early 90s, Part 2. This is it's a Substack called GoTo10, and mainly I just kind of wanted to bring this up just because I'm kind of new to Substack. So is everyone else more familiar with Substack than me?
It seems to just be blogs all over again. That's all I know about it.
I've only just sort of entered it into there, mainly just following some authors, things, people moving around with all the Twitter fracas that's going on at the moment. But I've only just got in there, so I have an account, that's all I can say. But it looks very bloggy to me. So like, let's blog all over again.
Well, it looks to me like it's kind of like a like Patreon maybe, or Medium or something, or actually some combination of the two, where you subscribe and yeah, you can get sort of like bonus content if you subscribe, and
paid and free content.
And it's also newslettery. Like if you set up a blog on it, you automatically get a generated newsletter of your content. I think that's part of the appeal. Mm-hmm. So it's like,
okay,
it's like RSS also all over again. So sort of reinventing blogs and RSS, I think, is what it's doing.
Mm. Interesting. But this specific use case of it, Paul Lefebvre's
we've gone off on a tangent again.
Is interesting. You know, like I get notifications of it. I haven't subscribed in the paid way, but I've subscribed enough that I get alerts about it, and the entries look interesting. So if you're looking for a Substack to read, this would be one to consider, I suppose. This one in particular that came up, I think this was just posted on Facebook, but it's sort of talking about remote computing and getting online. Okay, let's see. Maybe that is good enough for now for the feedback. So we could maybe turn to items of interest in news. Earl, do you have one that you wanted to talk about?
Sure. I can. I'm going to fumble a little bit with this topic because, it's actually moving so fast that the updates are all over the place. But let me tell you what I think I know. There is a eBay seller in Canada that for some reason, and I guess I could go read the background on this, but wound up with hundreds and hundreds of new in-box computers, retro computers, that are Z80 based. They are architecturally similar to, but not compatible with, as I understand, the MSX. They have some of the same chips that you might find in an MSX. They're called Nabu, N-A-B-U. They were used as part of what seems like a really groundbreaking, original thinking kind of cable TV subscription service, where you would get this computer. It's about the size of a VCR and the keyboard. Both of which are a separate keyboard, both of which are dark colored. And you would plug it into your cable and you would be able, as part of this service, to download software over the cable, which is a really interesting and cool idea. Almost like some implementations, it was a one-way download, but in some it was actually a two-way, so almost like a precursor to the internet. And so because these new in-box computers are now available and starting to get sold, on eBay, people are looking at them and going, what can I do with this today? If you just turn it on with nothing, it will come up with the logo and freeze because it doesn't have any cable service that it is connecting to now. If, on the other hand, the retro community, like they are wont to do, comes up with ways to hook this up to the internet, then that will be amazing and is actually happening. There's something called RetroNet. There's a series of videos that you can watch on this that we'll link to in the show notes. You have to do some hardware modifications to make this happen with your Nabu computer, but once you do, then I think the sky's the limit with what the retro community will do with these. And the person who's selling them, I think, got overwhelmed, sold a bunch, and then had to basically pause the eBay auction for now because he's actually taking them out of the box and making sure that they're working and that before he boxes them back up and ships them off. Adrian's Digital Basement, one of my favorite YouTube channels and also a local Portland person here with me, did a video on this computer. There's also another YouTuber named DJ Schurz, who we'll have a link to, that has done a big series of videos on this, including how you connect them up and do things with them. And they're doing experiments to try and figure out, how can I make this thing load software? How can I program it? Specifications and a lot of information have made their way to the internet. I think somebody was trying to hook them up with an ESP32 or a ESP8266, one of the Wi-Fi deals. Anyway, this is really exciting, and I wanted to buy one, but I went to click the buy now just a little too late, so I missed out on the first wave, and I'm hoping there will be subsequent waves, because also the person selling them was making available these computers at a very reasonable price, something like, I think, $60 US.
Yeah.
And that you're looking right now at an auction that's ended, right? Not a current auction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because if that was a current auction, I would be leaving the podcast right now and going to click buy it now, because I very badly want one of these, as do a bunch of people, and probably more will after we come out with the podcast. But just neat.
Yeah. My filters kicked in on this one, unfortunately, because I heard people talking about Nabu, and that's what I heard. They say Nabu, I heard Nabu, and my Gungan filter kicked in, but they do look amazing. I can tell you this, is going to be more than $59.99 US to ship it here, but I've definitely got to get my hands on one of these.
Well, as the token Canadian on the show today, I have to say I've literally never heard of this thing, which is fascinating to me. This was clearly an East Coast thing. It's not something that I had ever seen, which was certainly common in the 80s. The cultural divide between East and Western Canada was pretty deep. We didn't have the communication and the ease of travel that we have nowadays. So a while back, we talked about the Unisys Icon, which was a 8186-based educational computer that was used pretty widely in Eastern Canada. And same thing, I had literally never heard of it. So that's probably the same with this thing, but it's, pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
Ontario-based, wasn't it? Isn't that where these came from?
Yeah, this is apparently developed in Ottawa, according to the site we were looking at there earlier.
Yeah, so I wonder if, who knows, maybe Carrington came across it, who knows.
He might have, yeah.
Where does it show that they're shipping from?
Millbury, Massachusetts. So what's interesting about that is that it's like, you know, 45 minutes from me, so I might be able to just go get one, you know.
If you do get two.
Yeah. or if this person has anything to say about it, I would have to take 20.
Wow, yeah. Quantity 1,000 available. So he got a lot of these things somehow.
Yeah.
Wow, so that's saying, fascinating.
I don't know how that happened, but it is a real boon for us. And I know it's already happening that the ones that have shipped out to enthusiasts are already coming up with ways to run software on them and hook them to the internet.
Yeah.
And there's a re-implementation effort, I think, of the Nabu network that these originally connected up to.
Right.
Maybe it wasn't going to be Skynet after all. It was going to be NabooNet.
But so, I think it's one thing that's interesting about this is that, you know, there are many of them, and they are relatively easily available. They are cheap-ish. So I'm not sure that the computer is that great, but I think that, you know, there's sort of like such a small audience now, and they're so accessible that I think something may well come of this, because everyone who gets one is going to be interested in it. You know, it's not going to be there will be, you know, 900 users who are trying to use this, and, you know, other people who are using it on MAME, you know, so I think it is interesting.
It's new in box. Mm-hmm. It has a video and a sound chip. And again, I think it's similar technology to what you would have found in an MSX computer. So I don't think the specs are all that bad. I don't remember how much RAM it had, but it didn't seem like it was hurting on RAM either. So I think with all that, it's not that bad of a computer, even in its own right. It just can't run anything without connecting up to a network.
They talk about how the network works, and it looks like it works sort of like Teletext did. It just, you know, the network just constantly spits applications at you, and you just catch them as they come by. and it makes updating easy too, because, you know, they just send the new update around the loop.
Definitely a lot of potential in this. It's not as if 1,000 was suddenly just, you know, people just sort of like found them in the back of granddad's cupboard, but they've opened up. They're written basically in the hands of enthusiasts / mad scientist type. So it's definitely got the retro world attention at the moment.
And someone in the chat confirmed that they are 64K.
Okay.
So they're not badly spec'd.
Mm.
I wonder if anyone has gotten CPM running on it, if it's ZED based. Seems like a logical thing to do next. I guess it's got its own operating system of some sort, but it'd be cool to get CPM running on it and then maybe write some drivers or something or whatever you need to get the graphics chip going and stuff on it.
Well, it does have its own ROM, I think, as part of this whole effort, that some reverse engineering has been going on that too.
Santo in the chat says CPM 3.0 has been made to run on it, so
okay,
that's cool.
And somewhere in all of these videos, I'm not sure whose videos they are actually, but so there are actually a large number of YouTube videos now about the Naboo computer. But among the people who have been posting videos is somebody who I think his parents worked for the company or something like that. There's someone who had a family connection with it and had a bunch of sort of old documentation and was sort of getting things up and running again. Also, there was a fairly interesting sort of local news video posted by Leo Binkowski, who is a games programmer for this company.
And this video is incredible.
Yeah, and it's funny. They go to his house and they interview his parents, and his parents say, "No, we have no idea what he's doing, but we like that he's happy."
This is a 1982 time capsule. Yeah, here. Wow, this is incredible.
Yeah, and so this is just a, you know, sort of like just out of high school, you know, games programmer who goes in the middle of the night, blasts the radio, and writes, you know, arcade game ports for the Naboo.
That's pretty awesome.
Alienates people by you know, greeting his coworkers in his own made up language. Seems all very of a type.
Yeah, that's, we all know that person, I think.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward though to seeing what comes of this. So my thing is, this was actually sent to us by somebody. Mark on Twitter pointed this out. So it's a Adrian's Digital Basement Fest, but this is a video called "I Almost Threw Away This Historical Chip." Did you guys see this?
I did.
No.
Yeah. So basically the story was he had, you know, has piles of junk, and you know, periodically needs to kind of get rid of some of the junk that is taking up the space. And there was this sort of nondescript looking gray box. You know, it had a power cable and some wires coming out of it, and you know, very very clearly like a homemade thing. And he opened it up, and inside of it was a like white ceramic 6502. 5275, it says, very end of 1975, which is right at the beginning of when they were made. So these are of course, in general, they are you know, sought after by collectors just for the period. But you know, so part of the remarkable part of the story is that, you know, he was just about to throw this away, and he thought he would open it up first, quick, just to see like what the thing even was. But so he opened it up, and then, you know, the next thing to try to figure out is there's a thing here in the Wikipedia entry about this that points out that there was a bug in the first ones. So something about the rotate right instruction just did not work properly. And so the question now is, was this one of the buggy ones? And, like, you know, how do you find that out? So then a lot of the rest of the videos is talking about that, you know, like figuring out whether it's one of the buggy ones, and he got somebody to write code for an Apple II that did nothing but, you know, specifically check, you know, does rotate right work on this chip, and then he plugged it in and ran the program, and we actually, you know, now have this program we could run on our own chips if we ever were in this situation. And, ta-da, spoiler, this 6502 has the ROR bug.
That's cool.
It's very pleasing to see, because it's very pleasing that just randomness of this, running into this, and him knowing what it was when he saw it.
Yeah, I don't feel so silly now that whenever I go to throw out electronics or anything, I always open it up and strip it down, if only to sort of see, oh, that could be handy. Oh, I'll take those and store it. You never know what decade you might need to use that in.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely a case of don't throw it out unless you open it up, even just to have a look.
Yeah, he's so pleased, though. Yeah, I mean, like...
Yeah, I would love to find that.
This like, made his year.
Yep.
Well, it's just funny, these discoveries. Like, ooh, look, I have a first-generation 6502 with this rare bug. Ooh, look, I have 1,000 Nabu computers in my backyard.
And, I mean, you know, these are the sorts of things where if you actually went out to try to buy one, if you could manage it, you would be, you know, then broke for the rest of your life.
So. That must have happened to me then.
Where did you put it?
Is that what happened? Someone out there is probably going to be plying him with email saying, I'm building a period-accurate Apple One. Mm-hmm. I'd like your chip.
But the thing is, I wonder if the chip may, in fact, predate the Apple One.
Mm.
Like, I wonder if any Apple Ones were made with the bug.
Yeah, they're called Macintoshes.
Okay, anyway. Quinn, tell us about this Wonder Monitor.
Yeah. So I will share this tab here. So this is a Kickstarter for the so-called retro-styled modular IPS display. Not the superest catchy name, but... it's by a company, a fellow who is a company called Checkmate, and he's better known for making various Amiga aftermarket accessories. And he's come up with this thing, which the reason it came up on my radar because the Kickstarter was ending like 2 days ago as of this recording, and it was going to miss its goal. And through some very fortunate high-profile blogs and things posting about it, they cruised through the goal now. So, they're very, very successful suddenly now. Which is great because this thing is really cool. So it's a 19-inch IPS display, and I actually had to look up what IPS is. That's in-plane switching. It's a very high-end form of LCD. or LED display, much so better than OLED, which was sort of the previous king of the hill. So IPS is the new hotness, apparently, in LCDs. And this is a display it has kind of a retro look, so it would look at home on top of your Amiga or your Apple IIgs, something like that. And the secret sauce in this thing is that it has a modular backplane inside of it. So it takes these sort of edge connector boards with panels on the back of them. I'm trying to find a picture here for the stream. It has these panels that slide into the back of it. So basically it's like a retro monitor that has ports that are swappable for any type of display. So you can have one monitor that can run all of your retro computers and all of your retro game systems. And they show it running on old PCs. They show it running on a 2GS. They show it on running Amigas. It'll do composite. It'll do component, VGA, EGA, CGA. It does SCART. It does 15 kilohertz horizontal scan, so which is for like arcade video or some of the Apple IIgs and Amiga stuff. So it's basically one monitor that is supposedly able to run all of your retro systems. And I think that is pretty incredible. Now, the other thing that they've done with it is it's expandable in a more generic sense. So they have one of the modules that you can get for it is actually a Mister that you can plug into it. And if you're not familiar with the Mister, it's an FPGA-based emulator for all sorts of retro things. It's basically like a hardware MAME. So you can flash an Amiga 500 onto your Mister and it will emulate an Amiga 500 on the FPGA. So if you put a Mister into this thing, it effectively becomes an iMac, an all-in-one system for any retro thing you want. So if you want an Apple IIgs in an iMac kind of format, then this thing will do that with the Mister in it. So that's what it is. It's pretty incredible. So they are looking to ship this thing sometime, I think, like middle to late next year. So you can still back the Kickstarter if you want to get one of these things at a discounted price. And it has a bunch of options, so you can choose which modules you want it to ship with. And you can also choose, they have three different levels of display option, which is also cool. One of the options they have is a high-speed display, a low-latency display, because, of course, one of the challenges with the emulated video on a lot of these systems now, like you can buy these, you know, video converter boards on eBay or whatever to convert Amiga video or 2GS video or whatever. They always have a ton of latency in them, so much so usually that they're unusable for gaming. And so this thing, they have an extreme low latency option for this thing that's apparently nearly indistinguishable from CRT. And they've actually got a demo of that in their Kickstarter video showing it side by side with a CRT, so you could see the latency. And it's very, very low. So it looks like an amazing, amazing product, and I'm really looking forward to this thing.
So I guess a question that came up in the chat, and I wasn't clear on this either, looking through the Kickstarter. Yeah. Does it actually come with a display panel, the front panel itself? Is that a choice among display panels that you make based on what you were just saying about the latency?
When you order it, you order it with a panel of your choice. So they have three options for the actual panel itself.
Gotcha.
So yeah, there is some confusion on that. People now, the reason for the confusion is because the Kickstarter itself does not include the panel right now. But when they actually fulfill the orders for the Kickstarter at that time, then they will offer the panels and they will charge you an extra like £100 on top of what the Kickstarter was for the panel that you want, basically. So they're trying to be a little bit of everything to everybody. And so the Kickstarter pre-order that you're doing does not currently include the panel, but you'll get a panel with it when you complete the order, if that makes sense. So yeah, a little confusing. But here on the stream is a good picture of what the back of this thing looks like, which really, I think, explains how it works. So you've got a base input panel at the bottom there that's got, you know, 80% of your inputs that you're ever going to want. And then you can get additional modules on top of that for other types of inputs that you might want. So it's really neat, and it's all open source, so people can build their own panels or their own modules for it. It's a 4:3 aspect ratio, of course, which is good. It also does 5:4, so if you want to do PAL stuff, which is 5:4 ratio, it does that. So it's kind of the best of all worlds. And then being an LCD, of course, it's not nearly as heavy as a CRT, so you can put it on top of your computers, you can carry it around, do whatever you like with that. It's It is, of course, an LCD, so it's not going to have the blurring and stuff that we like from CRTs, but if you are going to go LCD, it's hard to beat this thing, I think.
And I guess it's kind of hard to answer the question, what would one of these set you back, because there's so many options.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've priced out a couple of combinations. They don't have final prices yet since they're still sourcing the panels and stuff, but it's going to be somewhere in the range of like 300 British pounds. So shipped to North America, you're probably looking at something like $500, I would guess. So, you know, not cheap, but not bad either for if it lives up to the hype of being a perfect all-in-one solution for displays. I think it would be worth it to me personally, like to be able to have like my Commodore, my Apple II Plus and my Apple II GS sitting on the desk with one monitor. Like, mm-hmm. You know, I would absolutely love that. So to me, that would be worth $500, but we'll see. I didn't back the Kickstarter, so I'm just going to kind of wait and see next year when they start shipping them, you know, if they're as good as they say they're going to be.
Mm-hmm. And a monitor that's not likely to go out anytime soon. That's exactly. The thing is that our poor old CRTs, if the tube itself has trouble, that's it. They're not making any more of those.
Yeah, and modern LCD panel interfaces have kind of stabilized. So if the panel goes bad, you can swap it out with a new one. You know, newer and better panels are probably still going to use the same interface. So you can swap that out as well. So that shouldn't be a problem. The one big question mark for me is whether it handles the Apple II's weird, not quite NTSC properly. The developer is kind of an Amiga and an old PC guy, so they've tested it a lot with CGA and EGA and Amiga stuff, and they have tested it with the Apple II GS, as shown in their video there, but I have not seen anybody testing it with an original Apple II, like with an 80-column card, for example, because that's notoriously difficult. Mm. None of these video converters ever do Apple II 80-column video properly. So that'll be the test for me. I'd want to see that before I buy it, I think.
Yeah, same here. That's what I'd want to see, because I've currently got a monitor hooked up to my 2C that can handle 80 column. But yeah, I wouldn't want to spend that kind of money without actually seeing it run.
Yeah, I mean, they're not Apple II people, so I don't think they've checked it yet. And I think non-Apple II people, they assume Apple II is just composite, so they have a composite port on it. And so they're listing it as Apple II compatible, because everybody thinks it's just composite, and Apple called it composite, and it looks like a composite port, but it's not quite composite. So, yeah, we'll see. I'm sure someone will test it before it's you know, fully shipping.
Wonder what it'll do on the Commodore 128 also, because that's RGB, but with the intensity bit.
Yeah, so that's cool. If you watch the Kickstarter video, or there's a Kickstarter video, and there's a YouTube review video where a prominent YouTuber was given a prototype to play with, and one of the developers of the display is a Commodore 128 enthusiast, so they specifically made it work with that. And in fact, they have a mode where you can switch back and forth between the two different displays. Like, you know, the 128, you can have two displays at the same time with the 128 mm-hmm. mode and the 64 mode, and it'll switch back and forth between those with a button on the front. So it's
cool.
Very 128 compatible by the sounds of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The front panel on it is modular as well, which is pretty cool. So there's, if you want to put different buttons on the front for different displays or things like that. So that's, extremely modular, basically.
Very nice. Curtis in the chat says that not quite NTSC is a problem with Cocos as well. So Apple's 2 and Cocos 3 need to be tested. There is one more that I will cover, and then we can move on to the next stage. Spritesmods.com, you know, for the season, I suppose. There is a 3D printed little IBM 5150 that plays Doom. It is a, you know, it is a Christmas ornament. It's a little 3D printed thing that has an actual screen in it, and it will actually play Doom. It will play the sounds, and if you have an appropriate controller, you can play Doom. So there you go. That's it's A for the season, but also B for DOS-cember, which is currently underway. So happy DOS-cember, everybody.
That's pretty fantastic.
That is neat. Although I don't think a 5150 could play Doom.
Yeah, that was observed.
And I will also point out that DJ Schurz, whose video series we talked about a few minutes ago, regarding the Naboo. He's joined the chat, so hello.
Oh, nice. Excellent.
It's great when we just say people's names and they show up in the chat.
And they appear. Yeah, it's awesome.
I didn't know we had this power. And Carrington. Nope. Right. Oh, well. Doesn't always work, I guess. Yep.
Carrington, Carrington, Carrington.
Yes. No, don't say it three times. That's and we'll never get rid of him.
But yeah, the yeah, we're really looking forward to the Naboo. Just to recap on that, it's been interesting to sit on the edge of what's been going on, and looking forward to seeing what develops, and hopefully getting some ourselves to work with. So maybe we can stream RCR to a Naboo app. It's funny, there was a time somewhat, long time ago now, when I kind of cringed at the use of the word app. It's like, this is not an app, it's an application. What kind of hipster speak is this? But
that used to bug me too, actually, yeah.
Yeah. I capitalized internet for a while.
I used to capitalize the I and the N in internet.
Oh, yes.
I was one of those. I've given up on that too.
I still shudder if somebody says on-prem. Mm-hmm. I have to ask, how much time did you save over your lifetime by not saying on-premises? What do you do with all that time?
God damn it, I'm hitting the space bar twice after every bloody period.
Yep. That's right. You can see it in my source.
That's right.
All right. Anyway, all right. And now, a word from our sponsor.
Everybody's planning to see Seattle's spectacular $100 million World's Fair.
Oh, pack up your troubles and forget your cares. Pack up your family and head for the fair in Seattle.
Welcome to the future and all the wonders of the 21st century in the greatest preview the world has ever seen.
Take away a head, look at tomorrow, just as if you were there.
Rocket ride to Mars in the breathtaking U.S. Science Pavilion. See the fabulous city of tomorrow in the gigantic, wall-less, pillarless Colosseum. Have fun with the happy-go-lucky crowds.
Back up the trouble.
For 6 wonderful months.
Back up your family and head for the fair.
It's the big thrilling adventure of a lifetime. Opening April 21st to October 21st in Seattle.
The MS-DOS5 upgrade is a hit, and no PC should be without it.
No PC should be without it.
DOS has 60 million users waiting. Time for them all to be upgrading.
Everybody DOS now. Everybody DOS now.
Gimme five.
Gimme five.
Gimme five.
Gimme five. No PC should be without it. No PC.
What exactly is Dataphone Data Service? Well, it's one of the many new and vital communication services furnished by the Bell System to the progressive dynamic businesses which are contributing to the nation's economy. What can Dataphone Service do for you? Well, for example, if the transfer of information is an important part of your business operations, Dataphone Data Communication Service can be a simple, practical help. In insurance, it transmits daily between business machines, claims, and other policy information from distant branches. In savings banks, tellers can check accounts with a central computer via dataphone calls. Hospitals can use dataphone communications to help give fast checkout service. Dataphone Data Service can keep information flowing to and from your offices, too, with great speed and at regular phone call rates. Why not call your telephone business office and ask to have a Bell System communications consultant contact you? Of course, there's no obligation.
And we're back. Okay, so the host's retrocomputing gift idea this time, I got this idea, I think I got out the Osborne 1, and I looked at the screen, and I thought about Brazil, and I thought, I bet they make little Fresnel lenses. And they do. So My recommendation this time is a little Fresnel lens on a stick that you can use to make your Osborne 1 screen reasonably sized.
Is that your photo, Paul?
That is my photo, yes, of this actual thing.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So it's you know, just sort of like, because the screen on the Osborne 1 is comically small.
Yeah.
And if you put one of these in front of it, it becomes at least sort of readable. So you have to be at the exact right angle. But I think it's kind of a nifty thing. It's inspired by the movie Brazil. And I'm pretty sure, actually, that they did... I think we've come across ads for this actual kind of device in the day. Like, back when they sold Osborne 1s, you could get a screen magnifier of this sort. But this is just a modern one. And quite possibly, you know, you could use it for other things as well. It is $23 on Amazon.
The intended use case, if anyone is wondering, is apparently for, like, reading a book or a newspaper if you are old and like us and need glasses.
Him, do, and may get one.
Who are you calling old?
Yeah. Yeah. I think you can get actually like big ones for making your television extra big, too.
That would be hilarious.
Yeah.
Have a gigantic magnifying glass in front of your 60-inch smart TV.
Turn your 60-inch TV into a 100-inch TV.
Right.
It just fringes a little around the edges, but I ignore that.
Yeah. All right. So when you're done enlarging your screens, you can move to eBay. Earl has the first thing to look at there.
So this is a refurbished, I guess I should probably, it's not really a refurbish. It's how would you call it?
It's reassembled.
A lot of work went into this. Let's put it that way. It is a reimagined Amiga 500 keyboard. And I think keyboards, including the keyboards that Commodore used back in the day, and modern keyboards too, are just too boring. They don't have enough color on them. And this keyboard has not just been cleaned when the springs replaced and other refurbishing and cleaning done, but a special color technique has been added to some of the keys, which introduces a bit of extra protection for them, while at the same time making the keyboard just beautifully colorful. Hmm. And I don't have an Amiga 500, and I also can't use a quartz-style keyboard. It's if I'm reading the auction right, it's not QWERTY. And I think it's coming from Poland. Maybe you could verify that, Paul. But you've got... some keys with a green accent, some keys with kind of a burnt orange accent, and the rest of the keys white. It's gorgeous. So I looked at this and thought, if I was one of the target audiences for this keyboard, I probably would have already bought it because it's beautiful. Yeah. And I wish more keyboards could have more splashes of color on them, which is why I highlighted this auction.
So this would swap in internally to replace the existing keyboard in an Amiga 500, is that right?
As I understand it, yep.
That's cool. That's a good idea. I'd like to see more of that. Like if someone made a nice refurbed keyboard for, you know, an Apple II or other machines, I would buy it.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I think I have a 500, but it's like a very yellow case. So it would be like a very nice set of white, orange, and green keys inside a kind of grungy looking exterior. I like it, though. Okay, Michael, you have the next thing.
Okay, so Fortran is my first programming language, and I came across Fortran 5. I start counting. So this is a album. So it's just a little bit something different.
An album, you mean like an LP?
Yes.
Oh, I see. Yes. It's not like 72 versions before Fortran 77.
But no, I haven't even had a chance to play this one. I found that they are available on the YouTubes and elsewhere, but having to do a little bit of a dive on this one, and I think I will grab myself an album just for something a little bit different.
Interesting.
But now I'm just waiting for the mega group COBOL to come to make their new release.
Right. Hopefully they will tour together.
Yeah, Dinosaurs Unlimited.
So do they wrap Fortran source code? Because I would definitely buy that.
I was looking for a Fortran manual just to add it to my collection, and I just came across this, and I just thought it was so amusing. As I said, I've been having a few computer issues here lately, and hadn't even got to downloading and playing it before today's show. So if anyone out there has listened to Fortran 5 before, let me know or warn me.
Excellent. Okay, let's see. I have a pile of things I will not get through, so I will start and we'll see how it goes. The first one I have is it's an Apple II, a very early one. So the price, by the way, just to start with that, it's a $7,400 buy it now. So, and you can make an offer. It's coming from New Hampshire.
My offer will be lower.
Yes, but I just wanted to point this out just because it looks pretty legitimate. I mean, like it's one of the things that kind of drew my attention particularly is that it has disk drive number 61.
Wow, that is a crazy low serial number.
Yeah.
Jeez.
I have the case. It's missing the analog board, but I have the case for number 145, and this has beaten me dramatically.
Wow, I've never seen a serial number that low. That's wild.
Yeah. If you look on the board, it says somewhere, you can see what it says on the board. The base pan says 3785 is the number. And the board number is a little bigger, but that's just because they sold some boards by themselves. So so the case number and the board number usually don't quite match. Can't quite find it. I know there was a picture that you could see it in, but anyway, it's
the case is vented though. So was it replaced or is it a later one?
I think the vented ones were the very, very, very early ones. Like I don't think there were 3,500 ventless ones.
Okay, but somehow this person got drive number 61. That's
yeah. Well, but the disk drives were later, right? So
okay. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
I forget when they came out. 78 maybe or something. Mm.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, for $8,000, I think it needs to be the ventless case. I mean, for that kind of money, I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's probably, it's a bit overpriced, but it is a rare object. And it seems like it's in pretty good shape.
It looks to be in very good condition. Yeah, that's for sure.
Lots of low numberness.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I usually don't see this much stuff together, you know. Legitimately, it's like an old case and then like a super new motherboard or something.
Yeah.
Super new in the sense of 1983.
Yeah, not many of the early ones survived without having the motherboard upgraded either because the user wanted an Apple II Plus because the originals didn't run anything or because it needed repair, so they replaced it.
Yeah. The next one, I made a joke in the notes. I said it's a very thin book. It is the terrific games for the TI-99 4A. It's actually not that thin, but I just wanted to make the joke.
Both our TI-99 podcast listeners just flipped their tables.
That's right.
That book was on the same shelf as ZX81 databases.
Yeah. This one, I guess I was just into the amusing stuff. So I was looking for 1962 things. This is you can find on eBay a number of things that are IBM postcards from the 1962 Seattle World's Fair. So I guess that happened and IBM was present. And this is a postcard that says "We live by the numbers" and has, you know, art on it or whatever. But on the back, it has somebody typed on it. This is being written on an IBM Selectric, tomorrow's typewriter today. Which I almost want it just for that typing.
That's pretty great. I love, yeah, the typos are chef's kiss. That's...
Yeah, the apostrophe is a quotation mark. Typewriter is misspelled. I did look it up, and like liquid paper actually did predate this, so this could have been solved.
Presumably that's something someone went into a store and like typed it just to try it out or something. Is that what this is?
I guess.
It's a funny artifact, though. I like that.
Similarly, I guess, it's just all comic today. But I wrote in the notes, I wrote a Craperweight. This is a Cray research paperweight. It looks pretty nice, actually.
Well, the dirty secret is that they're all paperweights now.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'll be here all week.
I actually want that. I don't know if I $40 want that.
Yeah.
But that is pretty expensive. Neat.
It's a model of one of the cooler Crays, the one with the bench seating around it.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
This seller has a couple of them, I think. This one was the one I liked the best, but I think there was one that's just sort of like a C shape, basically. We missed out, we didn't record last time, so we missed out on the Chrysler mug, which was the mug commemorating the first Cray Chrysler got.
Oh, wow. That's a funny clashing of worlds. Imagine a time when getting a computer was such a big event that they made coffee mugs for it.
Yeah.
That's kind of amazing, actually. It's a little window into the culture of the time there.
Maybe I should create a commemorative mug for my new laptop.
Yeah.
That's right. Michael's MacBook Air. Not the newest one, but pretty close.
Right.
Same performance for less cost.
I don't know if this is still... the only reason I brought up a Osborne 1 auction is just because this one is startlingly cheap. They usually go for more than this. This is one that's starting at a buy it now of $50, where you can make an offer. It's shipping from Florida and can cost a fair amount, but otherwise, I mean, like, they're usually six times this. So
saving that much money, you could get one of those magnifying glasses.
Yep. I also came across a screen glare reducer for the Osborne 1. So that's probably something you don't see very often, especially made for it.
Yeah, I remember using those on an Osborne.
There's no photos of it like installed or anything, so I think most people are going to have no idea what that is.
Yeah.
Just a single photo of it there tells you nothing about it.
Worked correctly to reduce glare on the screen on my Osborne 1 in the 1980s. So.
Oh, wow. So one owner.
Yep. Impressive. Yep. But I will be the second, and I will show you what it looks like.
Oh, you bought it. Of course you did.
Nice.
Okay, let's see. I thought this was interesting. Michael, I saw you clicking on this. Did you have a comment on this? This is the...
Yes, it's in my completionist list, mm-hmm. as you said, but not at that price.
Yeah, this is it's being sold at a buy it now of $400, which is probably excessive. But it's a Microsoft Mu Math system, and this is the first time I've ever heard of this.
I have absolutely no idea. I was aware of it, and I think this might be the same.
Is this? Is it just some kind of math software?
Yes.
Yeah, so it is Microsoft's fully interactive symbolic math system, set of programs which perform true algebraic and analytic operations that are beyond the scope of traditional languages. So, and apparently it's right there in the catalog, but for some reason I just always flipped past those pages.
So it's like a very early version of like Mathematica, sort of.
Yeah, that's what I would guess.
Powerful math software. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And it's in this very pleasing, you know, old-style Microsoft binder.
Yeah, every time I see it, I hear it screaming out, scan me, scan me.
Hmm.
I have a couple of these Microsoft binders, but they have games in them, because that's, you know, Microsoft made a bunch of early Apple II games, so I have, like, Olympic Decathlon, and it comes in packaging like that, because that was what Microsoft was doing at the time, so it's kind of a funny artifact now to look back at this very early Microsoft thing that is A, on an Apple computer, and B, is a game, and is not Flight Simulator.
Yeah.
and looks like business software in that kind of presentation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, everything they made looked like business software from the beginning, which is sort of funny for their early games that they published.
I think I have a gray binder that has like Adventure in it or something for the PC, you know, which really does, you know, it really just looks like all the rest of their software, except this one happens to have a dragon inside.
I think for a more reasonable price, I would love to have one of these padded kind of, I don't even know what color you'd call that.
Yeah, I don't know.
Microsoft brown.
Yeah, yeah, it's off kind brown. Of like the, whatever it is.
With the, you know, crazy pointy lettering that they had at the time, that branding. Yeah, yeah, I'd really like to have one of these.
Yeah, I've got quite a few pieces of software, various platforms and vendors that have those padded manuals from back in the day. But yeah, they're nice. I've got my VisiCalc on several TRS-80 and also the Apple in the padded brown binders as well.
Mm. Yeah, for some reason, nothing said business in the 80s like a padded vinyl binder.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Such a weird artifact. I like this early Microsoft logo, though. I think it's nice looking.
Yeah. Works well on the angle. It's very nice.
Yeah. What else? So this is it still available? Yes, it's a buy it now. It is a Suncom Joy Sensor Joystick Simulator. It says Joy Sensor Joystick Simulator. What it is... It plugs into your Atari or Atari compatible, you know, game machine, and gives you an Intellivision control.
I was gonna say it looks like an Intellivision controller.
Yeah, which seems like you know, exactly the wrong direction to go.
Yeah, not a well-regarded controller generally.
So, yeah, I think what was this? There was a review of this. Where was this? Of more dubious benefit is Suncom's Joy Sensor for ColecoVision and Atom, previously available for Atari. So this is when they expanded their offering from just Atari to other platforms. Gives you the controller utilizes a flat disk in lieu of a joystick and you know whatever. So if you want to trade joystick control for the type of control found in the Intellivision, if you want to. We suppose you can also replace enough parts in your Porsche to get the type of control found in a Buick, if you want to.
Wow. Zing.
Yes, this was a video on Computer Gaming Illustrated.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, though, the Atari joysticks are nothing to write home about. Like, the action on them is pretty terrible, frankly, compared to other joysticks of the time. So I might actually consider this if all I had was regular Atari joysticks.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like the Intellivision, though, so I'm biased, I guess.
Okay.
I'm one of the few people that actually liked the disc controller. It was certainly not well liked generally.
I think I'm sure you can get used to it, but yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, the games were kind of designed around it, so Intellivision games worked well with it. I don't think you'd want to use one on a Commodore 64 where the games were much more designed with an Atari joystick in mind in terms of the type of action that you're doing with it.
So the other thing, that came up when I was, you know, so I saw the controller. I thought, what is this controller? I went and looked up the review. On the same page, there's some discussion of the aerobics joystick. So pedal your way into the pink. Discusses up here the Suncom aerobics joystick. It connects to your exercise bike and your Atari so that it somehow, you know, provides you with a way to... I think you speed up the game by pedaling. like I think it actually does sense how fast you're pedaling and controls the speed that way. So interfaced between most standard exercise bikes and an Atari 2600. So
wow.
I of course immediately searched for this. I couldn't find one for sale or even any pictures of like how it works. So I don't know how it connects, but anyway. Okay, and I guess the last thing, this sold since I listed it, but it is a Bell & Howell Micro Module 85 Micro Trainer, and it's an 8085 trainer, which I think is actually the thing itself is fairly uncommon, and the chip is, I think it's what you have in the Model 100, is that seem right?
Yep.
So
it's in a nice case.
Yeah.
Mm.
The note I had in the notes was its best keyboard layout. And if you look, the numbers, they go 1, 2, 3, 4 up the left side, and then down 5, 6, 7, 0 in row 2 and column 2. I mean, and then continues down.
That's weird. Oh, that would drive you crazy today, because number pads have kind of stabilized in a certain pattern. So it is not that. Wow, that's crazy.
That pattern is not intuitive, no matter how you look at it.
No,
that's
terrible.
Is this being specifically designed to make people not want to go into computing?
That's right.
Why on earth would they do that? I can only think they did that because it was easier to wire it that way. Because then every key is adjacent to the one below it, kind of thing. So you don't have any like column and row wrapping. But wow,
it's weird. It's basically every columns 2, 3, and 4 are all at least ascending, except for the 0. I've seen some people speculate that in fact, actually, it might have to do with if you used octal for any reason, then the left two columns might actually be organized in a handy way for octal, I guess.
I guess. I think it's done for hardware reasons. I think it's because you can just wire them in a straight line then. Because if they've just taken a straight line of keys and they've wrapped it in such a way that every key is adjacent to the one below it and above it. So it's just easier to do the physical traces on the PC board. I put money on that being why they did that. But wow. That's
Chapter 1,
bonkers.
Lesson 1. Rewire the keyboard to make this useful.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'd have to unsolder all the keys and put some jumper wires on the backs of them, because that's crazy.
Yeah. Okay, so then I guess we are at a point several hours in for closing discussions, which I think also might include looking back at 2022 and thoughts about 2023, since we are closing out the year. Who goes first? Earl, you go first.
I can jump in. So, couple phenomena that I thought were interesting in 2022. One, it was the year that in-person computer festivals started to come back. And there, a lot of them were a blend of in-person and virtual. And I suspect that may be something that continues. And I kind of wished for that even before pandemic, because I was thinking, I can't get to all of them, but it'd be, you know, it's second best to be able to watch what's happening virtually. And the other thing was all the activity this year on the FujiNet, which we've talked about on a lot of episodes, but now expanding to other platforms like the Apple II in prototype mode, not in production yet, it looks like, and the Coleco Atom, which was interesting because a smaller user base, but I guess interest from the FujiNet folks. So and I think that's it. And I don't know what to say for retro computing in 2023, except I hope that it is the year that I get the Apple III running. I got an Apple III, and it's in really good physical condition. And the although there was a hint that it could have had some water or moisture damage on the inside when I got into it, I didn't see any of that. So just a tad of a musty smell, but not bad at all. So I'm actually very hopeful. I do have a question for you, Paul, on the Apple III. Does it have any bespoke chips inside, or are they like the Apple II more like commodity chips that you could buy? In other words, is there any chip in there that if it's broken is going to be more unobtainium?
I think there are some, yeah. So the keyboard, I think the keyboard encoder is something that you can get a replacement for from Joe Strohsnyder. There's like a video chip. There's a couple of chips in there that are kind of, I don't know the terminology for them, but they're, you know, like ROMs that are, there are ROMs in there that I think are masked, maybe. Is that the word you use? That like it's not easy to know what's on them.
Gotcha.
So, and I think the RAM can be a little bit hard to source because it's not the same, you know, sort of like simple RAM that was on the Apple II. They had
Well, I do have the 5-volt board.
Okay.
I have the the one that has the RAM that's a little easier to come by than the 12 and 5 volt one. So anyway, that's 2023 for me. I want to get that computer working because it's in beautiful physical shape and like to do some restoration efforts. I have all the gear to do that. I just don't have a lot of experience with it. So it's going to be a learning experience. It's going to be fun. And I'm on Mastodon. Let me see. I think I put my Mastodon handle in the show notes. Mm-hmm. Let me scroll down to it here.
You don't call yourself, right? So you don't know your own phone number.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like knowing your own phone number. It's at retrobits@oldbytes.space. So I'm out there in the Mastodon world if anybody wants to come find me. 70-some people have already, and it seems like a fun environment so far. I'm enjoying the... It probably won't keep that small-town feel forever, but at the moment, it's got a little bit of that going. So I like it. Mm-hmm. That's it for me.
Yeah, I sort of feel like it's enough people have gotten there that it's gotten to a point where it's sort of sustainable. I mean, you know, like most of the people that I talk with seem like they're there, or they're at least the people that are there are talking, you know, and I wasn't using Twitter all that much, but I sort of feel like I'm obliged to participate a little bit now and getting the Mastodon instance up and running. I'm somewhat optimistic. I really don't feel like I want to have anything to do with Twitter at the moment. So RCR is also on Twitter. We are, I should put that in the outro. I'll say that in the outro, but we have a Mastodon account as well.
Yep.
Michael, any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I'm with Earl. I've quite enjoyed the online presence at conventions during the plague time, and hope that they continue to do it. Because this last year, I really enjoyed going to, effectively conferences and meetups throughout the UK and Europe, and occasionally in the US as well. But it's really brought that home. So I'm hoping that in 2023, that there's a lot of continued, I suppose, hybrid platform for conventions and whatnot. It's always been difficult here in the Great Southern Land to get to Europe or to the North Americas. It's been a lot easier lately. Personal front, been having lots of fun scanning, expect to be doing more of that in the new year. I'm just taking a break at the moment. A few places I've basically have told people that's it for me. I'm taking the rest of December off from scanning. I was trying to get a new item scanned and uploaded to the Internet Archive per day, I think I was managing that. And time to, I think, get creative with my 3D printer rather than having it sit there. Almost feel like the enclosure I bought for it was more of a dust cover than an enclosure. But we'll just see. I want to get more creative and back into programming. I haven't been doing any serious retro platform programming for a couple of years now. But I definitely want to get back into that. So... You never know. I might actually get something completed for a change.
You'd be the first, I think.
Ah, I've got so many programming projects from years ago that I should dive in and at least close them off.
Let's see. For me, 2022, I don't know. 2022 began a long time ago.
Yes. So, 4 years. Yeah. Was it 3 years ago when 2022 started?
Yeah.
It's more than a year. It's got to be.
Yeah. Because I remember there was a time I spent a lot of time working on like this Apple III game that I wrote, and but that seems distant past. It was fun though. I mean, like I feel like I relearned a lot of assembly. So. hopefully I'll do more of that. I think I've just got a lot of sorting and scanning to do, though.
Yeah, I don't know. When you got I've got three different game engines effectively under development at the moment in various stages of incompleteness, and I've really just got to settle on one of them because they're all strategy game based. But I'm with you. So like, there's projects from the pre-plague days that I've really got to finish.
Though I think if we just give it another year or so, you know, ChatGPT should be able to finish all of these for us. what else? Yeah, I guess. So we're about to move the podcast away from Cyber Ears, probably also to a new host, which means everybody can look forward to 262 new episodes to listen to.
There may be some disruption on the feed, so
we will try
as a heads up that. We're going to try to avoid that, but in case that happens, please forgive us.
Yeah, but it's pretty certain, I think, that episode 263 will be on the new feed and site, so you can look forward to that. And I guess I've been playing around with Mastodon and remembering that it was December, just very late in the game. But anyway, so I guess I don't have really too much more to say on the past and future. Quinn, any closing thoughts or past and future thoughts?
Yeah, not a lot of retro stuff for me in 2020. It was 2022. It was
same difference.
I lost all concept of time. 2022 was the year of moving to a new country for me, so that really consumed my entire life for a year. It's amazing how much work something like that is. My goal for 2023 is to get my retro computers set up here in my new office. I'm having trouble figuring out how to do it space-wise. I don't really have room for a giant desk where I can just lay them all out, so that's part of why I'm so excited for this IPS retro modular monitor thing. If that thing pans out, then that would be a really good solution for me for how to get them all set up in here, because I really do want to do that. I'm sad that those machines, my whole collection has been languishing in my dad's basement for decades, and I really want to get it out and play with all that old stuff. I don't even know. I've got like 300 Commodore 64 disks, for example, that I have no idea what's even on them. So it would just be really fun to get that up and running and just start going through stuff and see what I've got and see what still works and what doesn't. My goal for 2023 is also to get back into programming. Like all of you, I have more projects than time, but I have some really fun ideas that I want to do over on the 8-bit side, but I try to not let myself start a new project before I finish the current one. That's kind of my personal rule. Otherwise, I'll just start seven things and I'll never finish anything. So the excitement of starting a new thing often motivates me to finish the current thing. So that's hopefully going to motivate me to finish my 2GS, shooty game that I was working on, the Sabotage / Scorched Earth thing with cats that I've been working on for like, I don't know, 5 years now, because I only ever worked on it in the dorm rooms at Kansas Fest and on airplanes to and from Kansas Fest. And so now for 2.5 years, basically, I haven't touched it because there's been none of those things happening. So I have to just sit down, I think, and devote some time to work on it, because it's getting pretty close. Like, it's playable, and, it's never going to be as complete as, some of the other retro programmers, do. It's not going to be a Jeremy Rand or anything like that, but I just want to get it to where it's playable and I feel good calling it, done. So that's the plan, but then I can move on to other things. So fingers crossed that 2023 is the year where I can finally get some traction on all that.
Oh, I have one question for y'all also. So with Septandy and December, it made me think Commodore needs something. I started scratching my head on what month could I do, some sort of a contortion of the month name. So, Commodore?
Commodore.
Does that work?
Yeah, I'm on board with that, yeah.
All right. I'm going to try and push it then.
Yeah.
Commodore October?
not as good.
Yeah.
It's a little longer.
Commodore Pearl?
Hard no on that one. We got it in one.
Yep, I think so. Yeah.
Comedy where it is.
I wonder if you could use those high density crank shelving units for like arranging your computer so that you could open up an aisle.
Oh,
for
compactus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
the aisles with the big cranks on them, so you can.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be great to have in here.
So you could, crank open the 1985 aisle.
Yeah.
Use those computers for a while.
Yes, that would be fun. Yeah. Yeah, it is important to me to have them set up, because I could, of course, just have a small desk and drag out whatever computer I wanted to use, and that's a perfectly viable solution as well. But for me personally, I just know that I'm never going to use them if I do that. They're just going to sit in the bins. So I kind of want them out so that I'll be tempted to just, I've got 5 minutes to kill. I'll just sit down and, play some Load Runner on the Apple II. That's kind of my goal, is to just have them to where I can do that. I suppose then they're going to get dusty, so maybe I'll have to have dust covers on them or something. But, yeah, that's a future me problem.
All right. I think we've made it through the episode and through 2022. So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com, soon to be on a new host, same address. You can just discuss the show on the forums at forum.vcfed.org/index.php/? Anyway, go to forums.vcfed.org on the podcast forum. You can follow RCR on Mastodon at podcasts.social@rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. Send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And please write a review on iTunes if you wish. And until next time,
Retro Compute.